Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muchen, and I'm in for Steve Bertrand, who is on the mend. He is reporting that he is on the mend, which we're really happy about. And I think he's actually listening today. He gave me some critique last week. So that's a little spooky. I feel like he's kind of stalking, but I guess he has a right to do that. It is his show. So let's kick it off today. We have the Chicago Inno guys, Jim Dahlke and Will Flanagan, general manager and editor. You guys have some great stuff today.
Yeah, thanks for having us. There's so much going on.
There's so much going on. And so here's, I want to start with this Northwestern, Illinois' first university-backed coding boot camp, which I know is a big deal. So,
yeah.
So tell us about why.
So coding boot camps are a big deal because there are a ton of unfilled tech jobs in the country. The White House had a recent study that said there are over 600,000 unfilled jobs. And when unemployment is still an issue, the fact that there's an abundance of unfilled jobs is like, all right, there's a problem, let's solve it. And a solution isn't, or a blanket solution isn't, two-year, four-year graduate programs.
Right.
That's not an accessible solution to fill that number of jobs. So coding boot camps are kind of part-time intensives. They range anywhere from 12 weeks to 18 weeks. You go in and you get the base knowledge of the skill set so that you can go from, you know, not zero to 60. They don't try to say that you're going to become a developer overnight, but you take that first step to get a junior role and then kind of develop the skills. So, you know, critics of coding boot camps said because they're not accredited, can we trust them?
Yep.
Or do they, you know, could they be a little spammy? So this is kind of a big deal because this is the first university-backed boot camp in the state of Illinois.
So, well, who's going to these boot camps?
They cater to a lot of people who are thinking of a career switch. You know, career marketers or people in finance who are seeing, you know, the average salary
really, so
of developers.
These are mid-level career people?
A lot of people, if you look at a general boot camp, a lot of it is those career switches.
Yep.
It's not so much, you know, young students right out of school, because if you're young and you know you want to be a developer, you're taking those classes.
Yeah, it's a part-time course. So I think largely they're getting people who have, you know, maybe finished their four-year degree and they're not certain if they want to go to grad school necessarily, but they don't have the skill set to sort of fill those roles, and they're interested in programming jobs, and a boot camp is a great way to do that. And like Will, like you mentioned, there are some regulation issues, and some critics are concerned about what's going on that side of things, and this is sort of a compromise, right? Like, this is a university-backed coding boot camp, which provides a little more gravitas than maybe just a traditional code boot camp.
So do you guys think that the whole idea of every kid should learn to code, is that really where things are today? Do you think that's going to become a thing, just like standard in curriculums?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, we're already too late on this.
Right.
It's one of those things where if you find yourself arguing the other side, like, you're wrong. Like,
yeah,
need to code.
At least just some base level knowledge. I mean, I wish I had.
Yeah.
I mean, even
my job
today, I wish I had a little more knowledge about coding than I do now. And if I had a kid right now, that's exactly the kind of career path I would lead him down.
I also think that it's a myth, or at least this is what I understand, that you have to be good at math in order to code. My understanding is that's not actually a direct correlation.
100%. So we've all heard STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. A new term that's getting a lot of popularity is STEAM, which adds arts to STEM. And one of the reasons that is because you have to be a creative thinker. Talk to any engineer and software architect. There's a lot of problem solving when it comes to code, and having that kind of artistic background or even just base knowledge is really helpful. So, yeah, and the other thing is when you talk about tech, a lot of these boot camps aren't just talking about hardcore coding. It's front-end design.
Yep.
It's UX. It's making having a great product is one thing, but every great product needs great design, and that takes a unique skill set as well, and that's where, you know, a lot of the art background comes in.
So let's talk about these young kids who are getting ahead of the game, okay? I love this story that you guys are coming with about a high school student, actually two of them, who are using artificial intelligence to make smarter breast cancer diagnosis. These are high school kids, right, at our very own Lane Tech.
Yeah, so one of them, Abu Kader, is the co-founder and sort of the CTO sort of behind this.
The mastermind.
And, yeah, exactly. He's doing the tech behind this. And, he's at Lane Tech here in Chicago, and he's got a really interesting startup, Glia Lab. It is bringing artificial intelligence to breast cancer diagnosis. So somewhere between 5% and 17% of breast cancer diagnoses are misdiagnosed.
Right.
And then another huge handful are overdiagnosed. So people are spending more money on treatment than they actually really need. What they're doing is building software that's between 93% and 99% accurate to give you a more accurate breast cancer diagnosis.
These kids were like 15 when they started.
This is a rising
right?
senior in high school.
But
right
it started
now.
2 years ago.
Correct. So he did this as a part of a sophomore high school project.
Oh my
just
God.
Doing some little computer science on the side, put this software together, and it's really impressive stuff. They're working on getting some funding right now and then potentially looking at bringing this sort of artificial intelligence software to other disease diagnoses down the road. So really, really impressive stuff.
I think that it's also, and I'm not trying to be gender biased, I do think it's interesting they're two boys. You know?
Yeah,
because
no, 100%.
Usually solving a problem like this comes from a personal experience. I didn't see anything in here that maybe their mother or somebody like that, but it's an interesting problem for them to have chosen to solve. Do they talk about why they did this?
Yeah, we didn't get into the personal motive. I mean, I think it just sort of was very serendipitous. I mean, that the things just happened to fall in place at the right time. I don't know if there is a personal motive there, but I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see not only where they bring this as far as breast cancer diagnosis, but then, I mean, how many diseases can we bring artificial
totally.
Intelligence to?
And don't you think it's interesting that they are actually at their age entertaining investor propositions? That's what they said, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they are getting close to raising about $400,000 for the startup, which is just enough to kind of hit the ground running for these guys. So, and they are working with some different hospitals to kind of get the beta test into these labs. So really cool stuff.
It's fantastic and inspiring, and I feel like it's a real credit to Chicago and our high school. So we've got this kind of creativity, as you said, Will, coming out.
Absolutely.
So we are going to be back with Jim and Will from Chicago Inno after a break, but it's time for Traffic Trouble Spots with Jill Egan. Welcome back. It's Suzanne Muschen filling in for the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand. We've got the Chicago Inno guys still because there's just so much cool news to report. So let's keep talking, guys. So you have brought to my attention this wooden smart clock that's going to keep you from constantly checking your phone. And this was developed by a Chicago startup. So tell me a little bit about the clock.
Right. So the clock is called Ingrain. It hit Kickstarter last week or the other week ago. It goes for $299 on Kickstarter, and it's raising a bunch of money. It's raised mm-hmm. about $50,000, so it's beat its goal. And what it does is it connects with your phone to give you the alerts and notifications that your phone will give you, but for your living room or your kitchen or your desk clock, wherever you choose to put this thing. So basically the idea is if you're hosting a dinner party, say you have your family together watching a movie, rather than having your phone, your head kind of buried in your phone, your clock on the wall can alert you when it's time to go to your next meeting or when you've got a text message.
Okay, I'm so troubled by this, you guys, so I'm going to tell you why. I feel like it's yet another device, mm-hmm. first of all. I'm going to need to keep this thing charged, sync it, the whole thing. That's one thing. But also, isn't this just putting another piece of technology to solve the problem of you spending too much time on your technology?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
right? I mean, let's be honest about it.
The smartest thing that people in Internet of Things industry came up with is kind of branding smart around all these devices,
right.
Smart clocks, smart watches, smart thermometers.
For
because really
people.
They're making us dumber. Because
right.
really we should be able to know when we have to leave our house. It's not solving the, you're buried in your phone problem. It's solving the I never have to turn my brain on problem,
right?
Which is a problem.
So, I mean, I understand that in theory it's a good idea. But so is what occurs. I'm having a dinner party. My phone is away. The clock is in the kitchen or the dining room. And is it announcing to me? How am I being alerted.
So it's got a display, so you can take a look at the clock, and it will sort of chime and let you know that, hey, this is something you need to take a look at, just as your phone would. So, I mean, it can do a lot of different things, too. I mean, I think I agree with you mostly, but I do see some benefits in terms of, you know, on your way out the door, you can it'll tell you what the traffic is going to be like. So rather than checking Google, you can know on your way out.
I hear you.
So there is, I mean, it's a lot of work to make you do a little less work. So I think there is a marginal benefit to be had by the clock, but mostly I think it's just people who already maybe have an internet-connected home,
right,
and they like that sort of lifestyle, and they think the clock, yeah, looks pretty sleek.
I mean, look, I did put an Alexa in my kitchen, the Amazon.
Oh, nice.
You know, I thought it was life-changing.
Yeah.
But not because it reports to me when things are incoming, but I can take care of my shopping list.
Yeah.
I can, just as I'm in the kitchen thinking of things, I just tell her what to do. She sets the timer if I'm cooking. She can tell me the weather. That feels, now I'm not making excuses for myself because
no.
I just said no more smart stuff, but that's at least me controlling the relationship with the piece of technology.
Yeah, and I think the value of those devices is that they can serve as a central hub. And when you get into having smart clocks or smart refrigerators or smart toilets, you end up having so many smart things that it actually gets hard to manage. So when you have like an Alexa or a Cortana, you have that hub that it's a one-stop shop. So where I think having that ideal piece of smart is great. When you start getting into, I have 18 smart devices, It's
right.
It's dumb.
So let's talk about a smart device that,
yeah,
you also brought to my attention, which I think I might be in love with. So this is the Zeke Smart Pillow, which in your pillow allows you to stream music. It alerts you if you're snoring. I mean, come on. If you have a husband, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever, don't want to be gender specific on the snoring, and helps you sleep smarter. This, to me, sounds like a good idea. What do you guys think?
A lot of people think it's a good idea, which is really cool. It went on to Kickstarter with a goal of, I think, like $30,000, and it's already in just a week over $150,000. So people are really responding to it, and I think it's a great idea. You know, everybody, you know, when we talk about, you know, using these devices to be smarter, I mean, I should know what's coming up on my daily schedule, but I don't know anything about my sleeping habits.
Right.
So that's where it's a really neat piece of technology that's seamlessly integrated into something that is a part of our life. I engage with a pillow.
Right.
Every day.
Right.
You know? Like, it's cool to make that smarter.
Yeah, the two things that I think are most interesting about this, which was another Chicago-made product, is one, the vibration it gives you when it knows you're snoring. So it'll force you to kind of shift your position and hopefully stop snoring, at least for a few,
wow,
minutes. And then the streaming music, like you mentioned, the way they figured it out is that your partner next to you won't hear the music. So you're the only one listening to it. So if you're the kind of person who likes to listen to music right before you sleep, it'll stream from Apple Music, Spotify, that kind of stuff.
I think it's a good idea. Do we know if it's comfortable?
They say it is. I haven't physically put my head down on it, but they argue that it is that they put comfort kind of first in what they were doing, so we'll see.
We love spotlighting these stories, too, because when a lot of the startup space is covered through venture capital, it's always cool to showcase the people who are making these products through crowdfunding. If you have a great idea, get it on Kickstarter and watch it roll.
Well, honestly, Jim Dahlke and Will Flanagan from Chicago Inno. Chicago Inno is a fantastic resource. I actually always use it to source my topics for this show, too, because it's just everything that's happening. So thank you guys so much for being on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's time for a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Suzanne Muchen. I'm in for Steve Bertrand, who is out but recovering from the surgery he had last week. And I think that, you know, Steve and I have been in touch the last day or two. I think he's getting nervous that I'm just doing so well on his show that, you know, maybe when he comes back, things are going to be a little different. So, you know, Steve, just if you're listening, which I know you are, just know we all love you. We miss you. And now in the studio, we have John Ross and Phil Waters, who are the co-owners of Chicago-based restaurant group B Hospitality, which operates its own original concepts, the Bristol, Fermentos, you might have heard of, Nona's, along with some of my favorite restaurants in the city, which are collaborations with the Boca Restaurant Group, Belena, Swift & Sons, and I just learned about Cold Storage next door. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the B Hospitality Group? I mean, I think what's funny about the restaurant industry is everyone thinks it's so fun to run restaurants when I think it's like the hardest job in the world. So what do you guys do, and honestly, why do you do it?
Well, it started off with John, myself, and our business partner, Chef Chris Pandell. We opened up the Bristol in 2008. That's in North Bucktown on Damon and Webster. And, you know, it was a selfish concept. We all wanted to perform in our own ways. John, high levels of service. I loved beverage in lots of different ways, from wine to great beer. And Chef Chris, he was classically trained in New York from such restaurateurs as Daniel Boulud and Andrew Carmelini. Well, after time, we found some success with the Bristol and met Rob and Kevin and collaborated with the Balena Project. And over time, it required us to stretch our management prowess. And so Chris is the active chef of Balena, of Swift & Sons, Partners in Formentos, chef of the Bristol. Wow. John and I oversee the properties in the front of the house and management of all the figures and so on and so forth. So that's thusly the need of Be Hospitality.
So John was absolutely right that, Phil, you do have a voice for radio.
Thank you for that.
What the heck?
I'll just stay at this spot for the rest
just
of the day.
Just stay. Now I'm nervous. You know, it's like a whole chain.
I told you were going to want to hire him after this.
Totally. Steve's afraid of me. I'm afraid of you guys. It's all
Christmas.
Okay, so there are some changes that you told me about that are happening at Formentos. So what's going on over there?
Yeah, we have a new chef partner, Chef Stephen Wambach, who is doing an amazing job. The menu has gone in a direction. It's much lighter, it's much brighter, it's much more vegetable and seafood focused. We still
Great.
Have some beautiful meats off our wood burning grill, but it's how we see the trend of Chicago and I think the country going. I think people are eating healthier. And we're trying to be a part of that on the street. So I think that instead of, you know, getting a chicken parmesan the size of your head,
right.
We're trying to do food that's a little bit more right size and more about the quality of the product
yep.
and not manipulating it too much.
And how does the chef come up with the menu? Is that a collaboration among a bunch of people or does the chef just lay it out?
Our chef has complete autonomy.
Wow.
So Chef Stephen and Chef Chris are pretty fantastic at what they do.
Wow.
That's what they do.
And so is there a market response? Like if you put out a menu and people don't order certain things, then what happens?
We have a lot of internal systems. We'll track the sales of each menu item. They get weighed out. There's percentages in a weighted average sense. And then we'll also take our outside feedback, you know, whether that's direct from, say, Open Table, Yelp, of course, is a big medium. And then we have our own external emails that go out, allow us guests to rate us. And we'll take all that information, come back to the table as grown adults and make decisions. But still, the chef has the autonomy.
Yeah, and going to the table whenever there's a new dish, whenever anyone orders it that night, making sure you get feedback from the guest and just, you know, asking them what they think. It's important.
And how is this 24/7? I always think of right? I mean, so do you go restaurant to restaurant? How does it work?
We split our time into the different restaurants. Honestly, the name Formentos is a family name for John Ross.
Nice.
Nona Formento, Lucille was her name. That was
Aww.
Her grandmother.
Yeah, it's my father's mother.
That's awesome.
She lived with us when I was growing up, and she's basically the reason I'm in this business. She would make pasta and meatballs and sausages every Sunday for our entire family, and so it kind of stuck with me.
You know, it's sweet. Unfortunately, my grandmother's family name was Bieberfeld. I just never thought that would make a really good restaurant name. So.
It's got a great ring to it.
Well, you can shorten it.
I guess. There's really no good way to shorten that. So you're always at the restaurants. And then what are the tough decisions you guys need to make?
Well, I mean, the industry itself can almost be perceived as covetous. Like, all you want to do is just cook the best things and drink the beautiful wines and throw great dinner parties. But at the end of the day, to be viable, it's still a business. So you have to make decisions that, you know, if it's slow times of the year, there's cuts. In the really great times, all you want to do is just stuff the wine cellar full of the best wines. But even then, you have to be held to your numbers. So, I mean, that's the hard part where you really are running a business.
And what's the most expensive bottle of wine you guys carry?
Let's see. I'm probably in the realm of a couple thousand, 2,000 or 3,000, I think, at this point. You know, we don't try to get to the 6 and 7 digits of some of the other restaurants. God bless them, but, you know.
We do have deep beverage programs, though. We're very beverage-focused at all of our restaurants.
What does that mean?
We take pride in it. We don't covet, as Phil said, but we make sure we have a good spread for the guests. But also, I think that, you know, we have a lot of award-winning wine lists at most of the restaurants.
Yeah.
A great bar program, so if you want a nice handcrafted cocktail, you can receive those as well.
Right. And do you guys ever spy? Do you go out and, like,
sit at
other...
I wouldn't say it's spying. I say it's enjoying.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you give all day long, you want to...
maybe get some return and go out there and enjoy what everybody else has to offer.
And there's also just being aware of the market. You know, if you don't know what's going on and you live in a vacuum, then right. you slowly become antiquated, quite honestly.
Right. It is so interesting to see the food trends and how they are being reflected in the menus in terms of portion size, you know, the farm to table. Mm-hmm. I think that's here to stay. What do you guys predict?
Well, we hope so. Yeah. I mean, I think that for sure farm to table. If you open a restaurant these days and you're not, I think you're going to maybe have some issues, you know, if you're a sit down restaurant. What do you think?
Well, I think you nailed it, John. There's an ethos to the food at this point, and people have a level of provenance where they're buying from the Green City Market, from handshake deals with farmers, and they want to know that what's coming across the table, they justify not having to do it at home. It's a profession.
Well, you guys are great. John Ross, Phil Waters, co-owners of the Chicago-based restaurant group B Hospitality, thanks so much for coming, and we'll be back with Jim O'Connor after this commercial break and a little more news. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Suzanne Muchen. I'm in for Steve Bertrand. And I am lucky to be on the show for lots of reasons, but partly because I get to bring in some of my favorite people from around the city. And I happen to have snagged Jim O'Connor as he's headed out on a trip. He's the global head of venture capital at William Blair and the chairman of the board of the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center, which is the mothership for 1871. How did I get you here?
Of course, how could I say no to you?
It just seemed like it was going to be like, well, I can't because I've got this and that. So thank you for coming in.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. And as you know, Suzanne, we've been talking about a lot of these issues for a long time. So appreciate the opportunity to chat with others about what's going on in the national ecosystem with entrepreneurialism.
So what is happening in Chicago relative to the coast? It always seems like we're being compared and maybe not so favorably, but I think that's switching.
It's absolutely switching. In fact, what's going on right now in Chicago is, we talked about it, almost a renaissance of technologies. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. I mean, the first being we have great universities. Foundationally, when you talk about Illinois, Northwestern, Chicago, right. IIT, DePaul, the Big Ten, we produce some of the top technical talent in the world,
right.
which the coasts have always known and always grab. And so more and more of these young men and women are staying in Chicago because it's great. You know, you look at Chicago right now, we've got great restaurants, there's so much going on,
right.
and they want to be here. So you've got that going on. You also have a lot of big companies here that is a second feature who want to buy the products of
right.
these startups, and that matters a lot. The coasts don't have that, particularly California. And then you have just a very entrepreneurial-friendly environment.
And do you think that the coasts are taking us more seriously today than ever?
Absolutely. I mean, I know in my role, I see it all the time. You have venture capitalists in both California and in New York in particular, and even internationally, who now look at us as a place where they should be looking to get good deals at a good price with top talent. And, you know, as many of the people we have on our board and locally who have had great exits who are building companies
right.
here.
Serious companies.
There's a sense of humility about Chicago companies when they build them here. They want to build them to cash flow positive. They want to build a sustainable company. You rarely hear them say, I'm building a product.
Right.
They're building a business. And I think this is very much Midwest thinking, or as we talk about Heartland thinking, that greater kind of Midwest sense of let's build a business, let's work together and help each other.
And you also talk about Chicagoness. So tell us what that means in terms of the ethos of some of the companies that you see here.
Yeah, Chicagoness is a really, you know, I think a great word that captures what goes on here.
Yeah.
You have, for example, in 1871, we have roughly 1,000 meetings a year where serial entrepreneurs, professors, leaders in industry come in and work with each other together.
You have voluntarily.
Voluntarily.
Right?
People
right.
that have taken companies public who want to nurture and help younger companies who've come out who do this for free,
right.
which is shocking when you tell this to people on the coast.
Right.
They're like, I can't believe they do that. And you and I know many of these people who individually spend several hours a day sitting with an entrepreneur they've never met to say, here's how you build a product. Here's how you would do this if you wanted to enter this company. Here's how you'd build a team. Don't do this with an NDA. It's all done for free. And that Chicagoness, it's that sense of giving for the broader community that's really kind of the essence of Chicago that you just don't see on the coast.
That doesn't make us any less serious about building big companies.
Absolutely. And sometimes people may intimate that hey, you know what, you're not as serious. It's very do-gooder. And I'm like, actually, no, because if you think about it, you've got now three advisors there that have all taken companies public or sold to big companies who are now helping you to genius entrepreneurs from the University of Illinois who are doing a security company, and then venture money comes in and flows. So it actually enhances it.
Right.
These people who do this help are also very capitalistic, as you know.
Sure.
They've made a lot of money, but they feel it's part of their world to help others and reach it back and get the next one. It's very rare in Chicago to see a successful entrepreneur not reach back and help another one.
So I want you to go back to the VC part of it. Are you also seeing Chicago being brought in on deals?
Absolutely. That change has occurred over the last 2 years.
Yep.
Right now you see many VCs from the coast coming to Chicago. You also see Chicago VCs doing deals across the broader heartland and in other areas as well. I mean, it's, as we've talked about, we are never going to be Silicon Valley, nor should we ever act like we're going to be Silicon Valley. It's like no one else can be Washington, D.C. That's the capital. No one else can be New York or L.A. They're different, right? We are the heartland, right? We're the place that grows things. Like if you talk about ag tech, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis. If you talk about fintech, you're going to go to Chicago, London, New York, right? If you talk about areas like Internet of Things, you're going to be in the Midwest because we have manufacturing here. So that's where the heartland is really, I think, the place that's going to spawn and grow new technologies that will benefit the U.S.
This is why I wanted Jim O'Connor on the show. Really, you articulate so well the ethos of Chicago as well as the edge of our business deals. So thank you so much. I know you're headed out of town.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jim.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Really
appreciate it.
Absolutely. Jim O'Connor, the global head of venture capital at William Blair and the chair of the 1871 board. We will be back in just a minute to wrap up the show.